The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Thank you for the good times. Thank you for your love. Thank you for the joy you've given me. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate. Increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio. The show is all about creating a better workplace and developing positive relationships where people can thrive. I'm Roy Saunderson, along with my colleague Max Brown, and we're from the Recognition Management Institute. How are you doing today, Max?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Good, good. And you know what? I'm really looking forward to speaking with our guests today. We have Bill Catlett and Richard Haddon, co-authors of the Counted Cows Leadership Book Series. Bill Catlett is a human resource consultant with 30 years' experience helping to build highly successful organizations. And in 1989, he founded the Westar Group, a human resource consulting firm, which concentrates primarily on the areas of employee relations, teamwork, leadership development, and business strategy. His corporate ports of call have included assignments with Federal Express, and where he was the managing director there. And he and his staff were responsible for developing many of the HR programs which enabled that company to become recognized as one of Forbes' five best managed companies, and one of the 100 best companies in America to work for. We also have Richard Haddon, and he's a certified speaking professional with a focus on employee relations and creating a great place to work. Richard's prior work was as director of product development for a software company in North Florida before starting his own software consulting business in 1986. He taught software design, principles of management, and international economics at Jacksonville University. And since 1990, he has delivered keynote presentations and training programs for more than 800 audiences throughout North and South America, Europe, and Australia. Welcome to the show, Richard and Bill.
Thank you so much.
Now, your books really have always kind of caught the attention with the wonderful cow on the front there. And as the Contented Cow Partners, you've been talking about employee engagement and its impact on business for many years now. Where do we stand today on engagement in light of the economy and the changing workplace? It's all in the news.
Roy, this is Bill. Should I take it from your question and talk it about 30 years of experience that you think we're getting old?
No. I've got the same experience. That's why we count on experienced people on the show.
We are. We're proud of it. I'm happy to report that despite all that's gone on of late, when it comes to the fundamentals of worker engagement, I don't think anybody has moved the cheese. I mean, mm-hmm. People still respond pretty much to the same stimuli that they always have. But, and that's a underline, but, because of the fact that we've skinned down our operations to bare bone, and I think it's fair to say the low-hanging fruit on the technology and offshoring trees has already been picked. The bottom line impact from the discretionary effort of each and every worker is more critical today than ever. And
yeah.
I look at it as kind of the new weapon of choice in the business enhancement game. And I guess that's kind of the easy part, though. And the hard part is that, unlike the fundamentals of engagement, everything else has changed.
Mm.
I mean, trust has been obliterated, and you know, whether it's in business, church, or government, people have understandably lost faith in big organizations. At the same time, the deal in the workplace has been turned on its head. And I mean, for example, I don't even like to use the word employee anymore because it signifies a relationship that, in most respects, doesn't even exist anymore.
Mm.
I mean, people.
That's interesting. because we are hearing this whole reference to, you know, getting people engaged rather than necessarily the employee part. And so that whole relationship disconnect has really kind of come about through this broken trust, hasn't it?
It does, and it's hearts and minds, one at a time.
So what makes a company a great place to work for, which I know you've both specialized on?
To me, it's three things. I mean, first, if you're at all labor-intensive, you got to start with great people. I mean, great performers don't want to hang out with turkeys, period. My daughter-in-law is a commercial baker in Savannah, and she's fond of the expression, great cakes start with great ingredients. And same thing's true here. I mean, of course, I mean, everybody says their people are great. I mean, just look at every company's annual report where it says that, you know, people are their most valuable asset.
That's right.
Really, like, what are they going to say? Our people are, like, kind of mediocre.
Yeah.
Two, you've got to be capital C committed, both ideologically and by policy, to being a special place to work. Because, I mean, there are times, lots of times, when you're going to be tested and tempted to take the easy way out. Tempted to cut corners and maybe hire somebody who doesn't fit your organization. Tempted to overlook poor performance. Mm-hmm. Tempted to tolerate a manager who, for the time being, at least, is getting pretty good results by running roughshod over her people. You know, and maybe tempted to send 50 people home so you can optimize the bonus pool for management. I mean, great companies don't do that kind of stuff. And I guess the third thing is you give people what we call the three T's of engagement. You train them, you make sure they have the tools to do their work, and then you trust them by giving them plenty of room and authority with which to do it.
So Bill, you said something, though, that kills me. Like, you know, you talk about people getting let go to optimize the bonus pool for the executives, and that great companies don't do that. But I'm hearing this all the time, and I'm astonished, yet maybe we shouldn't be anymore, that this is going on and it still goes on. And what were people thinking? How do they justify this behavior?
Well, it's easy to get in a funk, isn't it? Because you flip on the TV or you look at a newspaper, and unfortunately, that's not all we see, but that's most of what we see in here. And I think it's a little bit out of balance. There's a lot of good CEOs out there, and there's a lot of companies that are doing things right. And I'm not sure they get the credit they deserve. And at the same time, some of the creeps on the other end are getting way too much airtime, and we need to get the microphone out of their faces.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Now, you've used the term contented cows for many years now as a description. Mm-hmm. How do they perform differently from, say, common cows?
Well, let's focus on how they perform differently on the bottom line, which I think is what we're all interested in, or most people are.
Uh-huh.
As the basis for our first book, we took a long, like, 15-year look at six companies with deserved reputations for being good places to work. Not perfect, but very good. Companies like FedEx, my old alma mater, 3M, Hewlett-Packard, Southwest Airlines. And we compared the business performance of these six, what we called contented cow companies, to an equal number of their direct competitors, companies we called common cows, because they didn't enjoy quite the same workplace reputation. I mean, for example, we compared Southwest to United Airlines and GE to General Motors. And here's where it gets interesting. Over a 15-year period, the contented cows outgrew their competitors by a margin of 10 to 1.
Whoa.
Go ahead.
I just said, whoa.
Yeah. They,
10 to 1.
10 to 1. They out-earned them by $186 billion. They were anywhere from 2 to 5 times as productive and generated 16 times as much wealth for shareholders. I mean, you heard that correctly, 16 times as much wealth. And, you know, and the outperformance continues to this day, as evidenced by the fact that while companies like Southwest and GE continue to earn a profit, even in a nasty recession, United and GM are climbing out of bankruptcy.
Yeah. So we've had the good pleasure of being able to interview Southwest folks, and it certainly does come down to their real genuine culture and living the values, and the leaders getting it, that's for sure.
It does, because they're in the ultimate commodity play. I mean, you think about an airline, commercial airline, they're in the process of, you know, pardon the expression, putting butts in seats and moving them from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, everybody does the same thing, flying the same routes with the same equipment, serving the same stale peanuts. So how does one, you know, outgrow and outperform everybody else on a long-term basis, year in and year out?
Yep. Well, you know, I know you talk about employee engagement, and when you talk about employee engagement, we often hear the term discretionary effort. In our final few minutes, and I know you've writing about this in your Contented Cows Move Faster book, your most recent book, what is the meaning behind discretionary effort? What is it? What does it look like?
Oh, this is Richard, and I'm going to answer that. In the first place, we didn't coin the term discretionary effort.
It's
been around for a long time, but I think discretionary effort is best defined as that increment of human effort, the expenditure of which is at the sole discretion of its owner. Mm-hmm. It's that portion of effort that we choose to give. You know, it's the level of energy, physical, mental, emotional energy that we give because we want to, not because we feel for some reason that we have to. And we've used this, we've talked about, I mean, everybody has talked about discretionary effort for many years. We just haven't always called it that. We call it going the extra mile, going above and beyond, things like that. But it really is that extra effort that people put into things because they want to. And there have been a number of studies. We did one. Towers Perrin has done one. Gallup has done a similar study. They all indicate that people are really only giving about 60 to 70% of what they're capable of giving in the workplace, which means they're reserving about 30 to 40% of their capacity for something else. I don't know what it is, but it's not for their employer. And yeah, I don't think any organization can afford to leave 30 to 40% of its capacity on the table.
No. What do you think prevents people from doing that? What's the disconnect?
Well, we think that the primary source of it comes from people's leaders. And there are things that leaders do that cause people to make that choice every day to either expend or withhold their discretionary effort. And discretionary effort is a conscious decision. We make that decision every day to do that. And a lot of it has very little to do with compensation, with economic factors, and much more to do with what a leader does to engage that person and make that person sure that their choice to expend discretionary effort is going to be to their benefit as well as to the organization's.
Wow. And so are we having a hard time today with getting that discretionary effort when you look at today's workplace?
Well, we are. Apparently we are. But more than anything else, today in this economy and with what's happened in the workforce in the last few years, it's probably more important than ever.
Mm-hmm. And how are we going to make that turnaround? What would be your recommendation for those who are wanting an economic turnaround?
Well, really to engage people in helping them understand why it's in their best interest to give more of their discretionary effort. And that has to do with recognition, with leadership, with all kinds of motivational factors that people have. But it really does come, people talk about, the organization is a great place to work and so forth, and that's important, but probably more than anything is, are you as an individual leader a great leader to work for? And by your actions and by your commitment to the employee, do you cause those people to make that decision in the employer's favor every day?
And that's the key, isn't it? And that's what we need to kind of, I think, really gain, how we get that oomph, as you call it, getting people to put more oomph into their work. And we're looking forward to discussing this further with our guests today. I'm Roy Sonneson and Max Brown, my colleague. And today we're with our guests, Bill Caplet and Richard Haddon. And you're listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. Please stay tuned for more on Contented Cows Move Faster.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and myself, Max Brown, and our guests today, Richard Haddon and Bill Catlett. Thank you for being on the show and to talk about this work, because we talk about this discretionary effort and what's involved in asking people to do more and why they're holding back. I definitely want to talk about that. You describe in your work an ideal employee as having oomph. And what do you mean by that? How do you ensure that you can hire people who have it? And then maybe more importantly, how do you sustain it?
Yeah, and those really are the questions. Well, the term discretionary effort, those are awfully big words for people like Bill and me. So, and besides, we kind of think, a lot of people think that that term sounds a little clinical. So
yeah.
We've offered the more generally understood synonym for discretionary effort as OOMPH, O-O-M-P-H. And so OOMPH, you know, it's actually fairly easy to recognize and identify when you see it in people. For instance, it's when you set the alarm an hour early because you can't wait to get to work, not because there's something at work that can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
It's when somebody takes initiative to do something and they don't wait to be told. It's when somebody views their assigned goals as a minimum, not as the maximum or the end game. And it's really when you push yourself, not when you require pushing from somebody else. But it's equally important to understand that oomph is not workaholism.
Mm-hmm.
Two very different concepts. Psychologists tell us that workaholics are generally running from something. But people who work with oomph, and by the way, we call these people extra milers. Extra milers are running towards something that benefits their employer and that also increases their sense of satisfaction in their work. Now, as far as how to hire them, you really can, in many ways, interview for somebody who has the natural inclination to work with them. You can see it in somebody's tone, their demeanor in the interview. If they ask a lot of questions about, well, what's the upper limit of what I'm going to have to do, you know, they may not be a good candidate for as an extra miler. But you can also design the interview with discretionary effort in mind from a behavioral perspective. For instance, if you're looking for somebody with a behavior called initiative, which would be a key behavior to have for somebody who's going to be an extra miler, you know, we tell our clients that you would ask things like, tell me about a time when you went above and beyond the call of duty, or suppose you knew there wasn't enough business coming into your company, what kinds of things would you do to help turn things around?
Mm-hmm.
And then one last thing we found really interesting, and that is a history of volunteerism. You know, volunteering in the community or doing some significant body of volunteer work might be a good indication of somebody who can work with OOMPH. And you probably wouldn't disqualify somebody simply because they didn't have that in their history. But if you see that they do have a volunteer history, it could be an indicator that discretionary effort is at least a part of their nature. And it has to be developed and nurtured by their leaders. But if it's in there, it can come out. And I guess the logic is if somebody has it in their nature to work for free, you know, imagine what they might do if you actually compensated them. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways that you can look for it. And it's really critical to look for it, because if you want people who are going to work with discretionary effort, you can't expect them to show up on the payroll accidentally. You have to make that a part of your selection strategy.
Well, and I think this is key, but it's interesting to me that once you find these good people, it's very easy to, like, burn out this momentum that you bring in these wonderful people,
yeah,
but
yeah.
We can squelch this energy if we're not careful
exactly.
With the way we treat them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a classic pattern that people come in highly engaged at the beginning, and then after a while, if we're not careful, then they begin to doubt if it was such a good idea to come to work for this outfit. So we
That's
have to
right.
be really careful to monitor that and make sure that we sustain their engagement.
Well, and I've told this story on this show before, but I have a good friend who's actually been at a job for less than a year. When he first started the job, it's a very nice job, pays him very well. He's got a very nice opportunity, and he thought it would be a career changer. He'd be with this company forever. But recently, having had lunch with him, he said, listen, I've been there less than a year, and I already know they're just using me, and I'm just using them in return.
Yeah. And people do not want to be used, and they don't want to be taken for granted.
And I think that's key. You know, I've seen this with a couple of brother-in-laws. I've seen it with a brother who's actually the highest in sales. for his company, and he decided, you know what, they're just using and abusing me. He left for another company, and the old company was just like, well, you know, cost of doing business is the way we treat people.
Yeah.
Max, we do a lot of employee opinion surveys, and one of the things we see is that when you look at the demographics and study the results across various time bands of length of service with the organization, is that people generally come in, as Richard said, pretty pumped, excited about the new gig and new organization, new teammates. But then right about the one-year mark, things start to slide pretty precipitously. And one thing that we've strongly encouraged clients to do is to do what we call re-recruiting. You know, put yourself back in the mindset of when you were trying to woo this person to come to your place, you know, in the first place. And let's touch base with them, you know, throughout that critical first year. Hey, is it what you thought it would be? Is everything going well? Who's been especially helpful to you so we could recognize them? What hiccups have we had, and how can we overcome those? And I think we can forestall or prevent altogether a good bit of that if we're of the mind to.
Yeah, I think that's going to be key, isn't it? I mean, do you have any good examples for us that maybe our listeners could appreciate or learn from in how you can sustain that momentum, as you talked about, Bill and Richard, as well? Just talking about some of these best practices which actually impress you to sustain that momentum after they've already come in.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of it has to do with, as Bill alluded to earlier, do we give people the tools and the training? And, of course, in the last few years, the training has really fallen by the wayside. That's one really good way to keep people engaged, is to make sure that we're looking out for their development, personal and professional development. But, you know, one, I guess, a simple answer to the idea of the question that you've asked is to treat employees as individuals. One company that a lot of people are familiar with, especially in the Northeast, is Wegman Supermarkets. They only operate in a few states in the northeastern U.S., but up there, they're pretty high profile. In fact, in 2006, Wegmans was named by Fortune magazine as the best company to work for in America. I mean, think about that. It's a supermarket, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, after 3 days, their fish stinks, too. So it's not a real glamorous kind of a place to work. But and we did some research for when we were writing Contented Cows Move Faster, and actually went up and visited them and spent some time in their stores. And one of the things that impressed me about Wegmans is, I mean, it's a huge organization. They've got thousands and thousands of employees, and some of their stores are enormous. They have hundreds, you know, 400, 500, 600 employees, many of them part-time, just in one store. And yet, you know, a lot of times when you have both full-time and part-time employees in one particular location, the part-timers can get lost. But the management structure at Wegmans is set up so that every employee really, there's that word that Bill doesn't like to use, sometimes it slips out of my mouth, but every person, every worker has a manager, somebody whose job by design is to take care of that employee's needs and to get them engaged. And one way they ensure that happens is that managers are evaluated in part and compensated and rewarded in part on how well they engage their employees and how good they are in terms of leadership. And if we have time for a real quick story, I met a guy while we were up there who had been identified by his manager as a customer service hero. This is somebody that really went above and beyond, and that's part of their recognition culture, is to really make heroes of these people. And so I asked him, why do you typically go above and beyond here at work? And he told me that a number of years ago he had had a desire to relocate temporarily to another city about 5 hours' drive away where Wegmans also had stores. He had a sister who was from another country and who was going to be visiting in the U.S. for a few months, and he really wanted to spend some time with her. His manager took the initiative to ask him if he would like to temporarily relocate to this other location for a while so that he wouldn't have to drive down there every weekend, you know, and spend a few hours with his sister. And what that said to Bill and me is, you know, if you can find a way to link an employee's goals to something that was needed for the business, and as it turned out, this guy was really good in a particular training discipline, and they needed some additional training at this other store. So it worked out for everybody. But they would never have known that if they hadn't treated him and every one of their employees in an individual manner. And so I know it's a lot more work. It's more effort on the part of the manager, but it pays real benefits.
Well, that's a perfect example. I love them as an example as well. I believe they've been on the best place to work list for 11 years in a row now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're always near the top. They're usually in the single digits.
Absolutely. I think they're like number three or four this year. It's just unbelievable. Fantastic. And a lot of people want to work there for the amount of jobs they have available to the people that apply. It's unbelievable. People know this is a great place to work.
Yep.
Like you say, I mean, it's in our best benefit to do this, and they hold people accountable for doing that. I think that's fantastic. I guess for me and listeners that are talking about this say, well, what if I work in a place that doesn't work for me? Like, I am cynical about the relationship I have with my employer, maybe like my friend I referred to earlier. What do you say to someone like that?
Well, easy for me to say, but I would say find another place to work. Because there are other places to work, and, you know, it's a competitive environment. And even in this economy, it doesn't mean that you have zero options. So I know that practically and realistically, people are not as mobile as they were a few years ago and probably will be again in the future. But I think it's really important that if you don't work in a place that really engages you in what you do, and if you don't work for a leader who gives you the excitement to work with discretionary effort and work with OOMP, it really is in your best interest to don't just quit and stay, but quit and find another place to be effective.
Well, I think you make a very good point. Go ahead.
Rich really, you know, hit the nail on the head when he talked about, you know, finding the appropriate leader, because more so than ever before, who you work for, that human being that you report to, frankly, is a lot more important than what the name is on the paycheck and what job you're doing. And if you can find somebody who will take an interest in you, in your development, let you learn some things, take some risks, and, oh, by the way, they'll help you get up and dust you off and keep the organization off your back when you do, I mean, that's invaluable. And you can generally find those people at most places, but you've got to look for them.
You do have to look for them, and it's interesting because I think HR, they get a lot of these requests, don't they? Please, let me stay here, but I just got to work for someone different, XYZ. I know the good people, and they want to work for them.
And the really astute organizations pay attention to that kind of feedback and use that to develop the managers that everybody wants an exit pass from, develop them or get rid of them. And then they also notice those that the people want to go and work for, and they reward and recognize them for their leadership abilities.
Well, I appreciate this conversation. Unfortunately, we have to take a quick break. We got to let those advertisements come in, but please come back as we continue this conversation with Bill Catlett and Richard Hayden for more about getting people to put more oomph into their work. This is Real Recognition Radio with Max Brown and Roy Saunderson.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about: getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. I'm Roy Saunderson and Max Brown today with our guests Bill Catlett and Richard Hayden. You know, this has been a lively discussion. We know our time is running fast as we keep talking about contented cows. And I know in your last book, Contented Cows Move Faster, you said that with the imploding levels of trust in the various institutions in our lives, whether it be government, churches, of course, even our employers, it now falls to individual leaders
to be the primary link with workers. And you mentioned a manager at the Pebble Beach Company who is apparently good at this. Now, what's he doing that will be beneficial for our listeners to learn from? And I guess before you answer, do you guys get to play golf out there too?
Actually, we do have a standing offer to play on what is arguably, no, it's not arguable, it's a fact. It's the most beautiful golf course in the world.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was invited to come out for the U.S. Open, which is being played there the week of June 14th. And no, unlike the Connecticut politician who kind of fabricated his service in Vietnam, they actually invited me to work the tournament, not play in it.
Oh, okay.
Anybody who's ever seen me play golf wouldn't for a second think otherwise. But anyhow, they've got a lot of great employees and some very capable managers out there. And one of them is a fellow who actually makes the Pebble Beach golf course work. A guy named Hubert, and I spent a morning with him riding around the course in his office, which happens to be a golf cart. And I was struck by the fact that he's, you know, we're out there for a good three and a half hours, and he actively sought out and spent a few moments with just about everyone on the course, from guests who were playing the course, probably for the first time, to the caddies, the marshals, maintenance workers, and even contractors. And in the case of the Pebble Beach employees, I mean, he knew every one of them by name and a little something about them. But regardless, in every single case, the interaction was about them, not him.
Okay.
And in each case, his sole focus was to interact for a moment or two and see if he could do something to make their day a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff builds trust at the root level. And you know, because of that trust, the folks at Pebble Beach, they'd walk through fire for Hubert.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that him, or is that also the club itself and the business? Is it driven by the culture, or is it a personal choice here?
Well, I think the culture certainly appreciates it, and they try to collect people, you know, like Hubert. But in this particular case, it was funny. I mean, everyone who I spoke with, or not everyone, but a lot of people that I spoke with, suggested to me that this guy Hubert that runs the Pebble Beach Golf Links is somebody you need to talk with, because this is, if there's anybody here we got a clone, it's him. You know, and they were right. And he also explained to me, and he certainly didn't have to, he said this didn't come naturally to me. He said I had to learn it the hard way. And I asked about his background, and he had previously been a sergeant in the U.S. Army, in the infantry.
Okay.
And, you know, career sergeant, in fact. He said the thing that really bothered me when I left was that my soldiers weren't sad to see me go.
No.
And he said, I made a decision to do some things differently.
So that was a real internal change for him. That was a major motivation change. Yeah.
But I think it also shows that it's that most, if not all of us, indeed have the capacity to do a lot of this stuff.
So if we have the capacity, what's the disconnect for many of us?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's you know, it comes down to a couple of questions. One, do you want it bad enough? Because you know, leadership is not that complicated, really. It's kind of simple as dirt. But it can be hard to do at times, because it means oftentimes subordinating your self-interest to the good of the group, you know, to other people. I think also, in fairness, in a lot of cases, we've not always had the best examples set for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have a hard time breaking out of the mold of what we've seen done before. In some cases, and you guys know more about this than we do, our recognition and reward systems are a little backwards or perhaps ill-defined or ill-devised, and we wind up, you know, reinforcing bad behavior.
Yep. Sometimes we certainly do reward things we don't want. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a lot of new managers that are in place right now, and, you know, whether it's the economy or corporate cost-cutting, they're not getting the benefit of that management training that we're used to seeing happening, and in many cases probably not even having any training at all. What good help can we give them right now on the show? And I'd like you to kind of think about, say, just a minute or two of your best advice for these new managers who don't get the kind of training that you and I would like to see them receive. What do you think, Richard? Do we start with you?
Yeah, I would say look for what works for you and try to emulate it. So mm-hmm. when you see a leader who's, you know, when you see somebody that you admire, somebody said, you know, that person really inspired the discretionary effort out of me, look at that, be alert to that, be aware of it, learn from it, and try to the best of your ability to emulate it. And sit down with that person, if that person's accessible to you and available to you, and ask them, say, you know, hey, could you give me some advice? We're not getting a lot of formal training right now, but there's some things that I see that you do that works, and I'd like for you to get your help in doing that.
So you're talking about here being a good observers,
yeah,
and then not being afraid to ask for that
right.
help from others.
Right.
Good, good. Bill?
No, let's take a lesson from Hubert at Pebble Beach. I mean, a lot of people would tell you that as a manager, you've got to learn how to speak in public and do presentations, and, you know, I suppose you do, but that's not in the first 100 things to do on your bucket list. Besides, mm-hmm. you're going to wind up going to a lot of meetings and having your time wasted by boring presentations from which you'll learn plenty about how not to do it anyhow.
Right.
I'd say rather than learning how to do presentations and stuff like that, I'd strongly suggest you instead learn how to listen. Really listen, just like Hubert does at Pebble Beach, and it'll get you a lot further.
Mm-hmm. And so when you look at those listening skills, how do we... It seems to be a lost art, and I think that's probably when you talked about the level of trust that's diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Listening is certainly a factor. What other things are eating away at the trust? Or why have we gotten into the situation we're in with that lack of trust?
I think that as particularly as the economy has gotten worse, people have gotten wrapped up, you know, pretty tight in their own underwear. Very, very self-absorbed. We all are, and I include myself in that. And as a result, a lot of us who are in leadership roles have, you know, spent disproportionately too much time worrying about us and not enough about the people on our team. And mm-hmm. you know, here again, I mentioned this a moment ago, I think one of the best pieces of advice for young leaders is, you know, make sure you're working for somebody who's willing to invest in you, let you make some mistakes, protect you while you're learning, and sponsor you for some bigger and better things. Another one, I think, frankly, has... Again, we've pulled back our horns and slimmed down our organizations. We've just totally shut down recruiting, which, frankly, is the wrong thing to do. You know, and also in the process, you know, the most important decision you'll make as a manager has to do with who you invite to join you on your company's payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And learn everything you can about how to recruit, you know, as
right.
in source and screen and select good people. I mean, read the books, take a seminar, you know, and find somebody in your organization who is really good at it and study what they're doing. Because, you know, the gates are starting to open up. We're resuming hiring. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to be hiring tomorrow's problems today.
Yep. Right. Up here in Canada, we have a saying that says, if you want to go moose hunting, you got to go where the moose are.
That's exactly
You got to find where the good people are. Now, we know that management training is getting cut back. You know, what do you see happening with the future of management training?
Good question. I see three or four things going on. I guess, first, there's going to be more of it, if only for the fact that we've got a lot of catching up to do. We've effectively shut it down for 3 years. This is not an inconsequential fact, because the millennials demand it. You know, we've got, for the first time in a long time, three generations cohabiting, you know, in the workspace. And that's something we're gonna give some thought to. Second, training is going to continue to migrate to digital and self-paced delivery methods, albeit at a much slower pace.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in a headlong rush to take, you know, every stick of training and somehow put it into digital content. And, you know, it's more productive and you can, you know, more tightly distribute it. But it's not all going to be delivered in that form. Third,
mm-hmm.
I think training will become more a la carte as the training customer becomes the individual learner. I mean, traditional thinking was that the organization is responsible for doing all the training. All you had to do is show up and they'll furnish the uniforms, the time clock, the training and everything else. And that's new day, new deal. And more, we're responsible for our own development, which, frankly, is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we'll see disproportionate investment at the frontline level and for high-potential folks that the organization wants to hang on to because, you know, smart companies realize that one of the key motivating factors, one of the big engagement drivers for folks, regardless of the generational cohort, happens to be the opportunity to learn, grow, and develop.
Mm-hmm.
So at the very least, the people you want to hang on to, you're going to make sure they get some of those opportunities.
That's true.
And I guess just one more, if I could throw it in, is that I think we'll continue to see real growth in coaching at both executive and non-executive levels.
All right. When you talk about the executive levels there in our final 2 minutes here, what comments would you give for our listeners to get their leaders engaged in engagement? How do we get the leaders involved?
Forgive me for being so part-edged and having my green eye shape, but I think the place where we start is to show them that it's probably one of the best things you can do for your business. If you want to grow faster and make more money, this is one of the best ways to go about doing it.
So you think bottom-lining it is...
I do.
I think the employees got to appeal to the leader's appreciation for the bottom line.
Uh-huh. They're numbers people, so hit them with where they are targeting it.
It's really not a hard case to make.
A lot of people don't know this, but Gordon Bethune, who retired recently as CEO and chairman of Continental Airlines, used to be an aircraft mechanic. And one of the things he said is that, he said, do you know how much faster I can fix an airplane when I want to than when I don't want to?
Ooh, okay.
Yeah,
so in many ways, we've just got to kind of bring some of those metrics to the table, but to our own advantage.
Yeah, don't fight them. Use them, for goodness sakes. You know, the facts are just inescapable.
Well, this is exciting stuff, and I know that as we, as you say, get people to put more oomph into their work, that we'll get more of these bottom-line results. It looks like we're due for a short intermission, so come back for our final segment with our guests today, Richard Haddon and Bill Catlett. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about. Getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. Let's continue our conversation with Richard Haddon and Bill Catlett, our guests today, and learn some final pointers on getting people to put more oomph into their work. Richard, let's start with you, because I understand you guys are working on a new book called Rebooting Leadership. Can you tell us a little bit more about it, and when are we going to get to see it?
Well, second question first. We're saying late summer. That gives us a little bit of wiggle room, but I would say late summer, yeah.
Good.
It's when we plan to have it available. It's called Rebooting Leadership. The term rebooting, I guess anybody who's operated a computer for very long at all is more familiar than they want to be with the process of rebooting, starting over. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but mine, you know, if things just get so that they just aren't functioning, a lot of times the best way to restore functionality is just, you know, reboot the thing. And it's funny how, you know, it'll come back up, it'll reload all of its initial programs, and things will work certainly a lot better. And, you know, I think in the last few years, certainly our own operating environment in our culture and in business and at work has been thrown into chaos the same way computers can be. Because of the economic near meltdown, and some of the things that led to it, the financial shenanigans, you know, terrorism, wars, political strife, and a lack of trust, and, you know, Bill George, who's a professor at Harvard, called it, he referred to not subprime mortgages, but subprime leadership. And so what we're proposing in this book, Rebooting Leadership, is that that's exactly what we have to do as leaders in organizations. We've got to put our leadership system back on a solid footing and reboot the whole idea. But it's not about newfangled leadership. In fact, what we got to do is kind of do that initial program load again and return to the fundamentals of leadership. So we feel that the leadership fundamentals and the values and all of that is essentially the same, but it's got to be practiced in a way that reflects the new realities. And there are a lot of new realities. I mean, people are wrapped way too tight at work. Trust, as we've referred to several times in this broadcast, is really at a low point. And the whole deal in the workplace has been turned on its head. And so based on all the changes that have taken place, and we're looking back, you know, last 8, 10, 12 years, we really feel like leadership needs a reboot. So that's what it's about. And it's going to be very prescriptive. We'll talk about how to restore that level of trust. In the first place, the book is aimed really at first and second level leaders and those who lead them. But we're going to talk about restoring trust. We're going to talk about connecting in this new world. You know, we're kind of over-connected electronically, but at the same time under-connected relationally. We're going to talk about how to be bone honest with people. We'll talk about applying the concept of friending to building your network. And we'll also talk about how to fail successfully and how to flex and be resilient in this new world.
I love that. Some great comments there. And I'm going to catch on one point you made there at the end. Tony Dungy, in his book called Uncommon, he talks about how people celebrate him as a two-time Super Bowl champion, once as a player and once as an NFL coach. But he says, but no one ever talks about the 27 seasons of failure.
Yeah.
You know, and that somehow that you know, we really beat down on people for all these missteps or mistakes, and yet we really realize that failure is actually part of the process, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't learn without it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I appreciate that conversation. As we move a little bit around this, you know, a lot of our listeners are talking about, okay, so what about our workplace? And you suggest, you know, let's go find a new place if we need to, you know, because it is our life. I read a statistic recently that says 4 out of 5 people will fall short of their retirement business or their retirement goals, and probably won't be able to retire because they won't be able to save enough money. They'll either have to work longer or cut back some other way. It's an interesting indictment, I think, in where things are going, not only from an individual perspective, but I think also from a business level, because these younger employees, as they get involved in the workplace, are realizing, hey, I don't get the pension that my parents used to get. And the loyalty that my parents felt towards their company seems to be, they got burned by it. And so these younger employees are saying, listen, I would have been loyal, I even want to be loyal, but believe me, I'm not going to be, or I'm going to hold back until I know that someone's going to treat me with respect and loyalty in return.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Well, sure. I mean, I think loyalty, discretionary effort, all of those things really are reciprocal. And we see all kind of examples where when leaders are of the mind that, you know, what goes around comes around, and if I'm going to get exceptional output from people in the workplace, I've got to give an exceptional level of loyalty and leadership. But I also I think we have to recognize the reality today that people simply are not as connected to their organizations, and we're probably not ever going back to that. Bill and I know a guy, young guy in his 30s, who's had a lot of highly, you know, good professional jobs since he left school, and we were asking him about that, and he said, you know what, we don't marry our jobs anymore. We're just dating. And, you know, it really, when you think about it, it really is pretty much more the relationship, and I don't think we're going to change that. So I think we have to, as leaders, of organizations, we have to say, well, how can we engage people for the time that they're choosing to spend their time with us? How can we get the most from them in a way that really does work for both the person and the organization?
Sure. Let's do that a little bit more specifically around the recognition, if we could.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've weighed in publicly more than once, even on the topic of employee recognition.
Yeah.
What do you see out there right now in terms of what's working? And then we'll move through the list here, maybe what's not working and how you would offer advice on that. But what's working first?
Well, I think first we have to recognize the fact that reward and recognition, and of course those are two different things, but they're kind of clearly related.
Yes.
It works. I mean, for good or for bad. Witness the financial calamity over the last few years. A lot of people did what they did because they were rewarded for doing that, just like we were talking about before. And so we know that reward and recognition definitely has an impact, and that people are they do what they are incented to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of studies have been done, a lot of work has been done on what works and what doesn't work. And obviously, you know, compensation is important. I don't want to minimize that, but I think that's a fairly simple concept to apply. I think we have to look way beyond that. And I really see three things right now. And you know, the first of those is simply the very simple act of saying thank you, which we just don't do often enough. We need to say it. It needs to come out of our mouths. We need to document it. We need to put it in people's records. We need to write it out sometimes. Send them a handwritten thank you note, not an email. You know, we get 2,000 of those a day anyway. How many letters do you get from the boss that says, thank you, I really appreciate what you did? Sometimes we need to give them something to help remind them that the manager did say thank you long after those words have kind of faded out. So the simple act of saying thank you. But secondly, we know that people want attention from their leaders, you know, positive attention. It's just like kids, you know, up to a certain age, kids want their parents to spend time with them and to and to give them some attention. And the same thing with workers. Attention, positive attention, sometimes for very specific reasons, and sometimes just to, I don't want to say hang out, but, you know, just to spend time with them and ask them and talk to them. And as Bill was saying earlier, to really do some active listening. And the third thing really is to recognize people, to provide recognition for people by giving them opportunities to do highly visible work, to do very important work, and to take some positions of leadership in a project. So there are all kinds of ways that you can recognize someone's performance without writing a check. And the last of those, as I just said, is give them some opportunity to really do something that makes a huge difference, that gives them some visibility, and people eat that up. The kind of people that we want working in our organizations, they eat that up. And I said that was the last, but it's not. Also, attention to their development, as we talked about a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. We know it is becoming more the employee's responsibility to gain their own training and development, but if you've got a leader who is thoughtful enough to try to help you through that, then that's the kind of leader that you want to stay with.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we have about 1 minute left. Is there any parting advice you would leave for folks as we summarize this whole conversation today?
Bill, I've been flapping my lips long enough for the last couple of minutes. Why don't you take that one?
Yeah, there is. And it's something we mentioned in our new book, Rebooting Leadership. It's the fact that this period that we've come through here in the last 3 or 4 years, it's been very, very difficult. And, you know, in a lot of cases, some of the bad stuff that's happened has occurred as a result of just a very small group of people. Yet, I think we have to realize that at the end of the day, we all wear it. We all get painted with the same brush if you're in a leadership role. And Indra Nooyi, who's the chairwoman of Pepsi, you know, made a good point of that not too long ago. It says, look, we all have to step up and own it and climb out of this thing together. And she's absolutely right. And I think we've got to, you know, have our chin up and our head, you know, eyes forward, and let's just go do it.
Yeah. There's got to be hope. And as Roy and I like to say, we like to keep it real. You know, let's do this for the right reasons. Let's be authentic and genuine about it if we want it to make an impact.
You bet.
Well, I have really enjoyed this conversation, Bill and Richard. Roy, I'm sure speaking for you as well. Where are you at with this, Roy?
Well, I'm excited about the new book. I think you're taking on a new angle about getting back to basics, and we're excited about that. Would you be able to tell us perhaps how our listeners could find out more, where they can find you, and leave that as some parting thoughts?
Yeah, contentedcows.com is the best place to find us. And there's a blog post there, and also all of the work that we do, services and our books, and other ways that they can get help from what we do. We have a free monthly leadership newsletter, which we call Fresh Milk, and they can sign up for that online. So contentedcows.com. I emphasize the S on the end, contentedcows.com.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you both for being on the show today. It's been a real pleasure to have you here. Roy and I, of course, welcome all listeners to encourage your comments and suggestions, and we'd ask you to please email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We obviously look forward to hearing from you, and we'll try to put some of your stuff on the air as we get that feedback as well. Thank you for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, please visit us at realrecognition.com. Until next time, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Saunderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.